Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and earned an accounting degree from Eastern Michigan University. For 20 years, she held various senior-level positions with Suave Enterprises. In 2011, she joined United Road Services, Inc., as its president, and today is its executive chairman. She is also the chair of the Catholic School Council for the Archdiocese of Detroit. Her name, Kathleen McCann, and we're honored to have her as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to a lady that I've admired for many, many years, Kathleen McCann. Kathleen, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Oh, thanks, Jack. It's an honor to be here.
Tomorrow morning is Easter Sunday. Would you lead us in an opening prayer, please?
Oh, sure. Okay. Gracious and merciful Lord, bless this conversation and all those who are within the sound of our voices. Please shower your grace upon those that celebrate these days of Holy Week as we join in both the pain-filled and joy-filled journey from Holy Thursday to Easter. In a special way, please also bless our Jewish brothers and sisters who are celebrating these holy days of Passover. Fill all our hearts, dear Father, with gratitude for your incredible generosity to us, your love, and your limitless mercy. Amen.
Beautiful. Thank you. Can we start by talking about two people that you've adored, your mom and your dad?
Yeah, I've been blessed with wonderful parents. They were both Detroiters. My mom's mom worked at Jacobson's, and her dad drove an Ori bakery truck. They put their kids through the Shrine grade in high schools, and Irish and Scottish. They worked really hard, had great senses of humor. My dad was an only child, also raised by very loving parents. His father was the storied athlete, coach, and first All-American out of University of Detroit. And my dad, too, went to U of D High and then the university. He was an only child, but a great dad to six kids. And he was a gifted football coach as well. His career started in the Catholic high school leagues, and then he went on to college and two decades in the NFL. After my mom died nearly 20 years ago, he stood back and reflected on the need to be more intentional about telling his kids who he was. And then from there, he wrote three amazing books for us. First one called Opening Up, the second one called You Gotta Take the Good with the Bad, and the third one, Why I Believe. All great gifts to us kids.
What was it like growing up where your dad was a college and then a pro football coach?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, and people tend to romanticize what it must be like to be a coach in college or the NFL. But as a career, it's an extremely difficult road and takes a tremendous amount of sacrifice, certainly for the coach, but more importantly for his spouse and occasionally the kids. There's uncertainty, there's instability. You just don't know about retaining your income and your benefits. Your husband and dad is either a great guy or a total loser to the world, depending on whether they're winning or losing. We knew better, of course. The hours are insane. And, the press publicly beats up on those you love. It's a lot of fun when you're winning, but it's very, very trying when you're not.
How many times did you move? And what's it like being the wife of a football coach?
Gosh, I haven't really counted, honestly, how many times we moved. But we used to steal the old adage of Army brat, and we'd call ourselves football brats. I went to fourth grade in three states, for example, and it wasn't because I was a lousy student. It just has to do with the stability of the jobs at the time. But as, you know, the oldest of six kids, I was dropped off first, and then Dad kept moving, and kids were dropped off. My baby brother was the last one, and he was dropped off in Kansas City when Dad was coaching with the Chiefs. So, as you know, I think about my mom, a tremendous sacrifice and dedication she had to my father to allow him to live out his vocation and his dream. It was very, very hard on her, but she was as loyal as the day is long, and there isn't a bigger fan on the earth.
You got an accounting degree from Eastern Michigan University, and then you began your career as a CPA at Cooper's Librand. Tell us about that four-year chapter.
Well, it was a great learning experience. Public accounting, you get to see so very much, and that was my experience for sure. So many people, so many different industries. It requires pretty long hours, especially for the low guy on the totem pole, which I was initially, of course. But I wouldn't trade the experience for the world. It was a tremendous gift to me and ended up being a great launching pad for the rest of my career.
Speaking of which, from 1990 to 1998, you were with City Management Corp.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, while I was still at Cooper's, one of my clients asked that I be assigned to his account when he switched companies to go there as a CFO, and that was my intro to Suave Enterprises. And so I ended up staying for over 20 years at City Management and Suave. In the early years, we built this great company, City Management, and we became one of the top 10 solid waste organizations in the U.S. and certainly the largest in the Midwest by the time we sold. We had a terrific team. We grew organically, did lots of acquisitions, and created something really special. It was just an awesome experience, and I'm grateful to this day for it.
And then you sold that, and then Suave Enterprises from 98 to 2010.
Right. Once we sold City, it was time to start building out some of Tony's other companies. And we grew his beer business into the sixth largest Anheuser-Busch distributor in the United States. He built his scrap company, his real estate holdings, the dealership group, and other investments. It was a very, very entrepreneurial environment. No 2 days were ever the same. And again, I was exposed to a wide variety of experiences. It was really great.
We're talking to Kathleen McCann. When we come back, we're going to ask her about some of those 60-plus acquisitions. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Kathleen McCann. And from 1998 to 2010, she was the Senior Vice President for Suave Enterprises, where she oversaw the beverage distribution and industrial services companies. Kathleen, you and your teammates did over 60 acquisitions. How did you decide which opportunities to invest in and or purchase?
Well, I would say that the Suave team was pretty opportunistic. So there were a lot of companies that were acquired that were done so for various reasons. Sometimes it was a good tuck-in to an existing platform. Other times it was an opportunity for geographic expansion or synergies, or we wanted to add to the product offerings of an existing portfolio. But the standard analyses always played into the decision making. You look at cash flow modeling and how it fits and culture. But there was also a really good portion of what we did that was gut. Tony had a great gut for the deals that we should chase, and he was generally pretty right.
Speaking of Tony having a gut in general to be right, very few entrepreneurs have hit home runs twice. He's done it twice. Why has he been so successful?
Well, I think Anthony Suave, Tony, to his friends, undoubtedly is one of this area's greatest entrepreneurs. He's from pretty humble beginnings, hasn't really changed much. He's a voracious learner. and he's a studier of people. He loves hard work, and I think he takes intelligent risk. I would tell you that I think he has a very high EQ, present company accepted. I think he surrounded himself with some pretty talented people over the years.
What's the biggest thing you learned from him, Kev?
Oh, I learned a lot, but probably it would be details matter.
All right. 2011, why did you decide to join United Road?
Well, you know, after being at Suave for 21 years, there was a period of personal discernment as to where I was being called. And thinking that I was going in a totally different direction, there came an invitation to join United Road. I had a different plan, so I was sure that was not the right answer. But I spent quite a bit of time in prayer, asking for guidance where I was supposed to go. And ultimately, the answer came back pretty clearly that United Road was my next stop. And in hindsight, it was absolutely the right answer for me. And I learned again that surrender is totally underrated.
We're talking to an amazing lady who's very Christ-centered. Amongst the many things she's done is for 15 years, she's been the co-chair of the Capuchin Soup Kitchen's Sock Event. All right. United Road was founded in 1997. 1,800 employees today, plus 1,200 independent car haulers, $800 million in revenue. Tell us about United Road.
Oh, well, Jack, you've given some of the highlights. It's a really special place. I mean, we're a logistics provider with a specialty in moving finished vehicles. So we move 4.5 million cars annually for 10,000 unique customers. And we have terrific customers, a nationally integrated network, leading patented and proprietary tech, and really just some of the best men and women in the industry today. Our current private equity sponsor is the Carlyle Group, and we have way too many wonderful partners to mention. But I have to say that most critical to what we do are our car haulers, the men and women that are behind the wheel that make us who we are.
You and your team will move 4 to 4.5 million cars, SUVs, and trucks this year. You'll travel 150 million miles at 5 to 6 miles per gallon.
It's a big diesel bill.
Right. And if that gas tax in Michigan goes up, wow.
That's right.
New budgets.
Yeah.
All right. You mentioned the car haulers.
Right.
3,000 strong. Tell us about the car haulers.
These are amazing individuals, some of the best human beings with whom I've had the privilege to meet and work. You know, we've all had the experience of driving in or around large rigs hauling cars. But when you think about what these individuals do, they're athletes. They have geospatial skills. They have to solve puzzles, how to fit all these disparate cars and light trucks on the rig. They're technicians. They got to be very comfortable with the high-tech work of the equipment itself, and how we communicate with each other is all through technology. They have to be car lovers. And then on top of all that, they have to be able to drive 80,000 pounds with people all around them not necessarily paying attention, thinking they can cut in or eat their lunch or put on their mascara while they're driving around someone who's got a very expensive and a very heavy load.
When we had lunch a month ago, mm-hmm. I quote you now, Jack, the vocation of a car hauler and or technician.
Mm-hmm.
You view it as a vocation.
Oh, certainly. What we do is very, very specialized. And the men and women that do this, whether they're taking care of the equipment in the case of our technicians, or, again, driving the rigs and delivering the vehicles, these folks have this in their blood. It is a life work. It is a vocation. It's not something that people easily come in and out of. It takes great training. It's very difficult work. And once they learn how to do it and do it well, it is a vocation that they carry with pride and enjoy passing down to others.
You've got 3,000 of these teammates. Mm-hmm. Where do you ever find them? The shortage of workers today, yet alone these drivers, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, indeed. Our industry, we're a very small niche in trucking. Less than 0.2% of trucks on the road today are car hauls, car haulers. But in the industry writ large, the shortage is estimated to be 50,000 jobs that could be filled today with people behind the wheel if we could find those that wanted to do that work. And the number is expected to be multiples of that over the next 15 to 20 years. You know, most people never stop to think about the fact that nearly everything we eat, that we wear, that we drink, that we use, or even that we drive, has gotten to them in one way or another by truck. This is a wonderful career, can have great benefits, and the pay can be very, very good. Plus, you can see the country or work locally. So I would encourage people to think about being a truck driver or a specialized truck driver like a car hauler as a vocation.
If you want to learn more, www.unitedroad.com.
Thanks.
Unitedroad.com. All right, Ms. McCann. Once in a great while, a person goes from being an accountant to a CEO president. That doesn't happen often. You're one of those few who have done it successfully. How?
I have no idea. So, and I'm only partially kidding about that, truly. There's been a tremendous amount of help along the way, of course. So many who encouraged me and mentored me and helped me and allowed me to make mistakes as I was developing my skills. But certainly help and support from friends and my husband and family, and certainly help from above. You know the old adage, Jack, right? We plan, God laughs. Well, I would not have guessed in a million years that this is the path that I would be on, but it's been my path.
When we think of car haulers, we think of earthy people, locker room talk. I've never heard you swear. You're as classy and elegant a lady we're ever going to meet. You're like Tony Dungy with a football team. How has that been successful for you?
Well, I appreciate the comparison to Tony Dungy. I think he's awesome, but I don't know who told you that I've never sworn. Just don't talk to my husband or family or assistant. But to the extent I do, I brought it to the trucking industry. It didn't cause it in me, and thankfully, it's much rarer than it used to be. But I have to just say this: the stereotype of those behind the wheel being this rough and tumble bunch that only speaks spicy language is just not at all my experience. These are very respectable men and women who are moms and dads and sons and daughters, and they care about things that matter, and they're patriots, and they raise money for the poor and help each other, and they appreciate excellence, and they treat others with respect, including me, and they certainly have mine.
We're talking to Kathleen McCann, and I'm Jack Rasula. And this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Kathleen McCann, who's the founder and co-chair of the Fisherman's Fund. You're very Christ-centered, and you've surrendered to God. How can you have surrendered to God and also lead an $800 million a year business? That's an oxymoron.
Remind me not to tell you so much, Jack. But you're right. It would be impossible, but only if I didn't have total trust in God. In Christ, there's love and truth and beauty and joy. And whether we know it or not, we all surrender or give ourselves to something or to someone. And he's the most reliable promise by far that I've ever found. And he loves me, and he loves you, and he's asked for my trust, and it's his.
What did the Jewish carpenter teach us about running a business?
Wouldn't you love to have that conversation face to face? You know, how would you do this? How would you do that?
Not the way you do it, Jackie. You know, that's for sure.
But I think what we have in Christ, as I reflect on that question, is the perfect model of the dignity of work. So that work is actually a gift from God, right? His carpentry is one way of thinking about that. But it's something that allows us to co-create with God. It's a path to personal fulfillment and growth as human beings. In its best sense, it's used for the betterment of others as well. You look at Jesus and think about the lessons that we see. He was curious. He was non-judgmental. He was a great leader. He was an exceptional coach, wonderful teacher, and willing to sacrifice for those he led. So I think there are tremendous examples there.
And arguably the greatest storyteller of all time.
Indeed, right? Indeed. Yeah.
All right, we're in the middle of observing two of the three greatest days in the history of the world, Good Friday and Easter. When you see Jesus on the cross, Kathleen, what do you see?
It's been a journey in what I see, but in one word, love. So it sounds really simple, but I'm reminded, I can't remember who's responsible for this phrase, but I'm reminded of the notion that the only kind of simplicity to be trusted is the simplicity that's found on the other side of complexity. And when you look at the cross, at first blush, it looks like defeat and ugly and gruesome and failure and victimhood writ large, right? But no, much more complex than that. It's intentional sacrifice. It's fulfilling prophecy. It displays a love that is beyond anything we could ask or imagine. It's victory. It's victory. So death's defeated as Jesus will die and then rise again. So mankind, through it, is redeemed, as God promised from all time that he would do.
Speaking of which, tomorrow is Easter. What's the basic message of Easter?
Well, it's the day in the Christian faith, right? The principal celebration of who we are. And its message is one of hope and joy and redemption. Christ, a real human, at a real point in time, was raised from the dead. Amazing. Just amazing. And therefore, that means there's hope that we will be raised as well. After what he's done for us, now it's our turn to respond to him. That's how I think about it. And by the way, well, it starts Sunday, right? Easter lasts to early June. We can't just celebrate such a great thing in one day. We need a long time.
The last four Monday nights, the History Channel has had 2 hours of the life of Jesus.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
The other night it finished. And Peter, this one that he chooses to be the rock, to be the leader, at the Last Supper, Jesus says, "You're going to deny me 3 times before the cock crows." And sure enough, it happened. And then he dies. And they're all huddled up in this room. You know, the man they believed in is gone.
Yeah.
There's no hope.
Right.
And then Mary Magdalene comes and says, "I've seen him," on Sunday morning. And Peter says, "You're crazy. You know, don't go telling. You're crazy." And the last thing Peter wanted to do was face Jesus again. If somebody's really done some wrong things and is listening tonight and doesn't know how to forgive themselves, what do you say to that person?
Oh, well, I would remind them that when the Lord actually did show up to Peter and the apostles, the first thing he said was peace, right? That was the first thing. He came in love and peace. And all things are possible with God. All things. There's nothing that anyone has done, nothing, that he isn't prepared to forgive. You think about the prodigal son. The father sees from a distance and runs to greet the son. There's nothing. So I would encourage anyone who is feeling lost in that way, like they're unredeemable or unforgivable, to give the Lord a chance, because he's just waiting. He's just waiting. Just turn to him.
You're one of the most Christ-centered people I've ever met in my life. Hmm. And when we had lunch a month or so ago, I made the statement that, Kath, in the end, God wins. Mm. And you said, no, Jack, God has already won.
I said that, huh?
Many would say, who are you kidding? It sure doesn't look it.
Yeah.
Why do you say God has already won?
Oh, I think it's evident by what happened during this time that we're celebrating right now. He died, rose again from the dead, thereby defeating death for all time. The victory of the war has happened. We're just still dealing with some skirmishes. I think, as the Archbishop says from time to time, it's up to us to live out our lives in good fashion and in following Jesus and following the Good Father. The war has been won.
We're talking to Kathleen McCann, and I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Kathleen McCann, who's also the chair of the Catholic School Council for the Archdiocese of Detroit. What does that role entail?
Well, I work very closely with the Archbishop and a number of other individuals in the Archdiocese to support and focus on our schools. I mean, Catholic education has a long history in the United States and in Detroit, most certainly. And we have a lot of schools here still that do great work for our kids and their families. So recently, the Archbishop was interested in refounding our Catholic schools. And in fact, we launched a new vision recently that folks can find on the internet. There's been tremendous work that's been done for our kids, both Catholic and non-Catholic kids in our schools. So our first focus is on ensuring that there's a learning environment where kids can learn the truth of the gospel and have a personal encounter with Jesus Christ, that they can learn the fullness and truth of their faith and their academic subjects in the right way. And that's through the lens of faith. These schools are academically excellent. They have to be accessible, affordable, and they have to be financially sustainable. I mean, we don't get public money, right? And the one thing that I would say, the Archbishop, Archbishop Vigneron, for those that aren't familiar with him, he's just a wonderful, wonderful leader. And he's made it clear that this is an area where he intends, while he's here in Detroit, to put a significant amount of energy. And we all should, too. I mean, it's his view, and I share it, is that Catholic education is everyone's responsibility, not just those that have kids in Catholic schools, but not just those that have a school tied to their parish, but Catholic education helps the entire community that we're in, and it's really important that we keep these schools going.
The last year and a half, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church has been under siege.
Yeah.
And in some cases, justifiably.
Absolutely.
You think the world of Archbishop Ellen Vigneron.
I do.
Why?
Oh, he's a leader with a shepherd's heart. He's just done amazing things since he came back home to Detroit. And I think that all we need to do is look around to see the fruits of those efforts and those labors. I mean, there's tremendous momentum in the archdiocese today under Archbishop. Some listening may have heard about the movement to mission that's taking hold here, the unleashing, if you will, of the gospel. It's good to step back. So let's do that. Step back and just take a look at the historical timeline of what's happened in the Archdiocese over the last number of years. When he got here, the first 5 years or so were really spent right-sizing, eliminating and stabilizing some parts of our institutions. There was a lot of heavy lifting to do, sometimes very painful but necessary heavy lifting. But then let's fast forward to 2014. So that year we have a year praying for a new Pentecost. Come, Holy Spirit, right? Help us understand what is God's will for us here in the Archdiocese of Detroit. Then we have the Year of Mercy and a powerful Mass for pardon. Then we have broad discernment throughout the Archdiocese of Detroit, capturing over 11,000 pieces of feedback and information from the faithful about what they feel God is calling us to do here in the Archdiocese. And then that leads into Synod 16, which was a 2016 meeting of over 400 people throughout the Archdiocese to talk about what is our future, what is our future path. And then from the fruit of that synod comes the pastoral letter, Unleash the Gospel. And this pastoral letter is just replete with amazing, amazing things. This letter's been read throughout our country and indeed in a number of places around the world. So I encourage everyone to read it if they have not. Then we have 70,000 people fill Ford Field for the beatification of Solanus Casey. I mean, there are just signs and wonders everywhere as we move from maintenance to mission in the Archdiocese. You only have to look around to see it.
We're talking to Kathleen McCann. Kath, your dad passed 2 years ago, March 10th.
Mm-hmm.
A great mutual friend,
mm-hmm.
someone we really admire, Father John Ricardo, said the funeral mass.
Right.
What was his homily that day?
Yeah, it was an incredible time. Her dad passed away in his sleep with no warning that his time was near, so a great blessing, but a great, great loss. But we were able to bring him back to Detroit from New Jersey for his burial, and Father John generously celebrated the Mass. Now, they had never met, but Father John had read a couple of Dad's books, so certainly he was no stranger to him. As we entered the church, one of the things that you do in the celebration of a funeral mass is stop at the baptismal font and bless the body. And then from there, we process into the church. And as we processed in, Father John had a vision. And what he saw was as if we were walking through a tunnel, like at a football stadium. And coming through that tunnel, the noise began. And it wasn't just polite applause. He described in his homily the pounding of the stadium, the recognition of a life well-lived and applauded by the communion of saints and all those that are up in heaven cheering all of us on. And it was a very comforting, wonderful vision, certainly. And he further went on, I have four brothers, and three are still living with their kids, to talk about the importance of fatherhood and certainly the great things that Dad has done as a father for us. And he also talked about the importance of meekness in leadership of a father in particular, and how my dad throughout his life had become meek, power under control. He was a very powerful man, but he was such a gentle man. It was just a wonderful, wonderful celebration of life.
Tell us the story about your dad's wallet.
So I don't believe in coincidences. And there have been many similarities of my dad's journey and actually Father John's journey. So again, they never met, and my dad had only heard Father John celebrate a Mass once when he was in Michigan visiting. But nonetheless, he was quite taken with him and his gift. And Father John had been quite taken by my father's books and the life he had lived as well. And so it goes. He comes home. Father John's able to adjust his schedule and celebrate the Mass, which was a wonderful gift to all of us. Well, when Dad died, I put his wallet in the dresser drawer and didn't think about it. And a couple of years went by, and my sister was over one day. And I went into my dresser drawer to get something for her, and I saw my father's wallet. And I pulled it out, and I said, "Hey, look what I found. I've never gone into this." And so we both opened Dad's wallet, and in it we found the Mass card for my mom, who had passed away nearly 20 years ago, my brother, Michael, similarly, and then the Mass card honoring Father John Ricardo on the 20th ordination of his priesthood. How he got that, I haven't any idea. But it was quite something to know that he was carrying the Mass card of the priest that would help to bring him home.
Thank you. As we end, could you lead us in a closing prayer this evening?
Sure. Dearest Lord, as we celebrate these holiest of days, help us to better understand all that you have done for us. You've created us in love and have never left us. Even as we've rebelled over and over and over, you've rescued us over and over and over until finally, in this most amazing way once for all, through your cross and your resurrection from the dead. And now it's our turn to respond with love to your generous heart. So help us, Lord, to respond with a love for you and our brothers and sisters, particularly those that do not yet know you. Give us the joy and courage to share your good news and to unleash your gospel in Detroit and throughout the world. Amen.
Kathleen McCann, thank you.
Happy Easter, Jack.
For all you do and for who you are.
Thank you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahom.
Believe in yourself.